Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Ault, Serious Eats chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a serious eater like you has sent us.
What you really need to do to impress a judge is show them, you know, who you are and what your cooking is, and you have to have personality.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guests, Chef Ivan Orkin and writer and man about food and media, Chris Ying, the co-authors of the Gaijin Cookbook.
Kukiyomu, which means like reading the air, and Meiwaku, which means being obtrusive and getting in people's way, and that the Japanese, I always say like I feel like Japanese people, not all, of course not all of them, but in general, almost like they have an invisible bubble that spreads 3 feet all the way around them.
But that doesn't close them in, but that like they're aware of everything.
No, but they're aware, and if their music is a little out from the headphones, they'll notice it and turn it down.
So it's a semi-permeable memory.
Yes,
for sure. Semi-permeable memory.
And finally, on today's podcast, a teachable moment in Serious Eats Test Kitchen.
European style butters tend to be a little bit softer, which makes the dough squishy, and this is America.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Ault. And Kenji, Serious Eater Christian Hiller says, I've been following you for years, Kenji, now, and nothing has influenced and elevated my cooking like you and The Food Lab. Can't wait for The Food Lab Part 2. Now I'm looking to compete in the Swedish Master Chef.
Okay.
What dish would you suggest one making for the audition to impress the judges?
So first of all, we're assuming right now that you've got some pretty good technical chops and that most of the people who are going to make it on this show have good technical chops. So you have to have personality. You know, it's like writing. You know, anybody can put words together and write a coherent sentence, but finding your voice is the difficult part in writing. And it's the same in cooking, you know, figuring out what it is that makes your cooking uniquely you is tough. But that's the kind of thing I think you do need to bring to a competition show. You need to show your personality, especially a televised one. You know, you need to show your personality both on screen and in your food. So the answer, I think, for how to impress a judge is to be confident. Find a dish that you love to make and that means something to you and that you've made many times and that you know is delicious. And even if it's very simple, just be confident with that choice, because the one that means the most to you, I think, is the one that you're going to cook most passionately and that's going to speak loudest to the judges.
And isn't it also people tend to want to impress the judges with complicated
more stuff? Yeah. I've fallen victim to this for sure. Yeah. Where you're like, all right, I could do this. So, you know, because in the real world, when you're designing a dish or when you're writing or something, there's always time to edit, right? Like, so my process is generally I just throw a bunch of stuff up and then edit and cut, you know? Whereas on a competition show, especially a timed competition show, and I've never seen Swedish MasterChef, so I don't know exactly what it's like, but assuming it's a timed competition show, you don't have time for those edits. So you start making things and you're like, all right, like I already got this going, I have to use it. I'd say that would be one bit of advice I would have for anybody on a cooking competition show is like, it's okay to start something and abandon it. You don't have to finish everything just because you started, and putting more components in a dish might be sort of technically impressive, but it's not what's going to win the competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Christian, we wish you luck. We've never seen Swedish MasterChef, but I'm sure it's the same as the MasterChefs all over the world. I thank you, Kenji, and I know that Christian thanks you for your wisdom. Kenji Lopez-Ault is Serious Eats' chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Ivan Orkin is the owner of two terrific restaurants in New York City, Ivan Ramen and The Slurp Shop. Chris Ying was one of the founding editors of the late lamented Lucky Peach, an executive at David Chang's Major Domo Productions. Welcome back, my friends. Let's talk about the Gaijin Cookbook. I think the subtitle says a lot. Japanese recipes from a chef, father, eater, and lifelong outsider. So how did the idea for the Gaijin Cookbook come about? It's like, did you have to fulfill a contract? Or, you know, like I've been around the block a few times.
It was interesting. The Ivan Ramen book was very successful, I think. We were very happy with it. People received it well. It sold well. And then Chris and I went off in different directions. And then Chris, I think, you know, the Lucky Peach thing stopped and he was getting into other stuff and he had some time and I had some time and we stayed close and we talked mm-hmm. a lot and saw each other, you know, when we could. And then one day, you know, one of us said, you know, maybe we should do another book. And it's funny because the book really would look nothing like this when we first started talking.
So what was it going to be?
It was going to be like, what was going to be like another, what was it going to be like? Was it like memoir-ish?
No, I was not going to write another memoir.
It was going to be
I can't remember what it was.
No, I know. I think it was the Chris Ying story with recipes by Ivan Orkin.
Right. It was Ivan telling my story. No. It was, I know what you're talking about, Ivan, but what happened was the Ivan Ramin book is really more about the spirit of what Ivan did. And there's a very, very true and serviceable ramen recipe and a few, you know, side recipes in there. But it was really about Ivan's story, which is so incredibly compelling. But, you know, we made it very clear that it wasn't a traditional cookbook, and yet it did bother us to some extent that, like, there was not enough stuff in there for you to cook from.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really speak to home cooks who wanted to recreate or to taste these things or create.
It was very niche.
And so we started talking about, can we do a book that's more about actual cooking? And Ivan and I just started talking. Actually, we were in Australia together, I think, talking about this. And he was talking about home cooking and things like that. And I wanted to do it very badly because I had, you know, eaten with Ivan so many times. And I loved the food he cooks. But I wanted to figure out specifically what it was that made a Japanese cookbook from Ivan and me worth buying. Or
right.
What the perspective was that made sense. And we went through all kinds of runarounds, but pretty quickly arrived at this thing that Ivan's a gaijin, I'm a Chinese guy, I'm a gaijin. Like, we got to lean into that and just...
Yeah, you have to lean into your outsider-insider status.
Yeah, we can't hide that. There's no point in pretending otherwise.
Well, it's also, you know, the fact that you brought up the whole cultural appropriation thing, which I have lots of mixed feelings about, but the fact is that I have never pretended to be anything but myself, and everything.
I think you and I can both attest to that.
Yes,
right? Can
yes.
we not?
Yes.
I've never seen Ivan stop being.
I wish
Ivan.
You would pretend a little bit.
You know,
more.
Like first of all, have you ever seen the way he holds a fork? It's really.
Yeah.
You know, he has to do better.
It's like the first time he's ever seen one. Yeah.
Yes. But so I don't. I you know, but the whole idea of being the Gaijin cookbook is this. This, you know, everything I've done, the whole Ivan Ramen thing was really more of just my expression of my love for Japan and everything Japanese and wanting to share Japan with people. And yet, you know, Ivan Ramen is not a authentic traditional ramen shop. It's my shop. I mean, I lived there for a long time. I know what really good ramen tastes like, and I had to make ramen that Japanese people would enjoy. So it leans towards very Japanese because
right.
it would have been stupid to try to
sure.
do something that people didn't understand. And that's how I've become a cook, and I've raised children in Japan, and I have a woman that I married from Japan, and so I cook food from her country, and she's mm-hmm. been my tutor. And we've worked together over our marriage to make great food for our kids and to create a Japanese feeling in our home because I think it's important for her to feel comfortable and to have a slice of her life at home.
Got it.
And so I think that we started talking about, like, well, how do we lay this out there? And it was a lot of fun because there was a lot of ways to sort of create the structure of the book. And we had the recipes. That wasn't really hard. It was more about, and Chris really coming up with some really great ways to slot in all these different recipes and all the little vignettes, these little stories of things that happened to me while I was living there.
Yeah, Chris is a storyteller. In another story about you that I read, that I like telling stories about people, whether through food or other lenses, it seems to be what I'm good at, and it makes me feel useful to society. I now have that over my door. Because it's really true. And I think you had stories that needed to be told. You honed in on a specific story, this outsider-insider story. And then that was your point of departure for the Gaijin Cookbook, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Ivan has all these stories to tell. And in this case, my only job was to figure out how to organize them. What was the central thing behind the stories and recipes that he used at home? And I asked him, I said, name for me the five things, the five big takeaways for you about living in Japan, whether or not they're cliched or original or whatever. And those things he said pretty much ended up being the way we
organize the book. Down. That's fascinating.
It's almost exact. And it had nothing to do with food, actually. You know, like he would say, like, oh, I found everybody to be so courteous and thoughtful. And it speaks to this thing called
Meiwaku Kakenai.
Yeah, which is just like reading the air around you and understanding, like, if I'm sitting on the subway and I spread my, like, man spread, like, it's going to bug people. And right. I shouldn't do that.
That's the two ideas, you know, kukiyomu, which means like reading the air, and meiwaku, which means being obtrusive and getting in people's way. And that the Japanese, I always say, like, I feel like Japanese people, not all, of course, not all of them, but in general, almost like they have an invisible bubble that spreads 3 feet all the way around them.
But that doesn't close them in, but that, like, they're aware of everything.
No, but they're aware, and if they see garbage on the floor, they might pick it up.
Right.
And if their music is a little out from the headphones, they'll notice it and turn it down.
So it's a semi-permeable memory.
Yes,
for sure.
Semi-permeable memory.
So let's talk about the organization of the book. Each element, right? So the first one is eat more Japanese.
Right.
So where'd that come from?
Well, I mean, it's healthier a little bit. I mean, you know, not to go too extreme, but it's on the lighter side, right? Japanese food. And
that chapter has its own sort of breakdown of it's funny because that it's a little sideways reference to Lost in Translation, where, you know, you've got Bill Murray's character sitting in this hot tub and he's calling home and he's in Japan and he's like, I just want to eat more Japanese when I get home. I just want this lifestyle, you know. And what does that mean? What does that mean to eat more Japanese? Like, it seems so silly. It's like, I think the average American would say, I guess that means like more raw fish, more sushi or something.
Greater use of chopsticks.
use of chopsticks.
Do you, like, how old were your kids when they knew how to use chopsticks?
Oh my God, 6 or 7 maybe.
And your child is
my kid's turning 3 and. She started eating some rice with chopsticks, but is mostly getting closer to stabbing her eye with them. Than
sounds like a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
So eat more Japanese. Really?
What it really boiled down to us was these other things. It's like this attention to detail, like these little things of how do you make a pot of rice properly? Like, I should focus on that. There are these kind of essential core flavors to a lot of the dishes. It's things that Americans really love already. It's salty, sweet. Umami, smoky, like it's stuff like that's barbecue, right? we love those flavors inherently, and so do a lot of, you know, it forms the core of a lot of Japanese cooking. There's umami and this understanding of umami and how to use it. It's not just about like putting as much umami as you can, but how it plays with saltiness and fat and sweetness and things like that. And these kind of, and then there are some core in dishes and ingredients and things like that. But that chapter, that first chapter was just, you know, a lot of it was based on Ivan's memories revelations he would have about how certain flavors would show up over and over again. And it really informed what his particular notion of eating Japanese started to mean.
Got it. But I love the fact that only Chris Ying, by the way, can I say this, would have taken something that Bill Murray said in Lost in Translation and put it into a cookbook format.
Well, he's like the classic image of the gaijin.
Yes.
Like Bill Murray walking around Shibuya, you know? It's like,
yeah, that movie's all about that. So the next one is open to anything. Is that a Japanese concept or is that a concept that you just wanted to talk about? Like, how did that come about?
Well, I think it's funny that the Japanese are open to anything as long as it's exactly the way they want it.
No, I think it's funny, right? Like, that was a thing that Ivan taught me about was, God, everyone thinks that Japanese culture is so impenetrable and closed off. But Ivan would be like, you know, that thing you're eating, that curry or that menchikatsu or whatever, you know, that's not originally Japanese. And they're like, I've been saying that because, and how do you put it? You talk about like, they just like are so open to outside influence and then they will bend it to their will.
Yes. Yes. I mean, they're very, very open to taking
is
something.
Is that going
to
be on your tombstone?
It's funny because but you know what? All cultures are interesting. And, you know, sometimes when we start looking at other cultures, we tend to be terribly critical because it's not like our own. But we're all basically the same, and we all have the same desires and hopes, and I think the Japanese are not necessarily that much different than the Americans.
Chris wrote an entire book about this issue, yes. Right?
It's true.
And what's he called?
You and I eat the same, and that was like the central tenet was we are all similar in our desires and even our preferences, and the only thing that makes it seem different is this packaging.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. I said, like teriyaki sauce is delicious for the same reason that barbecue sauce is
yeah.
delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Japanese. So I think people don't realize how many things that they think are purely Japanese are just so not.
Yeah. It's much more universal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Interesting. So the next one, and this is the most cosmic one, is empathy. It's particularly resonant in 2019. Given our current political climate, not just in
mean?
The U.S., but all over the world. I'm serious.
Yeah. You know, for sure.
You know, I'd like to blame it all on our current president, but it's happening all over.
Absolutely.
So talk about how empathy relates to a cookbook.
Well, it's what Ivan was just talking about, that when I asked you about the things that stuck out to you, you talked about, you know, this semi-permeable bubble around everybody and how they were aware of everyone. And look, you can tell me this is a stretch or not. Ivan certainly never said it was a stretch, so we went with it. But man, some of the most delicious comfort food in the world is Japanese, whether it's like donabe stuff, like the rices and soups and stews cooked in these clay pots, or tea or dashi, ochazuke over rice. Like, these things just make you feel good. And I don't think it's a stretch to believe that a culture and society that's based around kind of awareness of others and their feelings would be super good at making food that makes other people feel comforted.
And it's also, you know, it's interesting because even just going back to the whole Bill Murray thing, you know, when, you know, people, I mean, part of all this is just getting to people to wake up a little more and notice Japan more and encourage them and say, you really can have all those Japanese flavors. I'd say the most unsophisticated person in this country still knows the basic flavors of Japanese food, but they've never really thought about really being able to, you know, make them at home.
Mm-hmm.
And that whenever someone I know goes to Japan and they've been waiting years and years to go, they finally go and they come back and they just, I'm already planning my next trip. I can't wait to
yeah.
go.
Everyone says that.
Yeah, it's just, and it's like that. You get, Japan is so addictive because it is. Everything there is so thoughtful. It's all been thought out so carefully and it's all been laid out. And when,
well, like you said too, like a lot of your personal comfort points became Japanese. And I think that happens for a lot of people. And that's what this chapter is about too. It's like you go and you're like, this thing that I thought was so foreign to me actually has become like a sense of, you get a sense of home from eating this food.
Yeah, like probably a lot more things as a Jew who grew up in Long Island, you couldn't imagine these Japanese flavors becoming comfort food, that these associations are of comfort food,
yeah.
right? I mean, yeah. obviously.
Although in my case, it's more of a mother who didn't nurture me, so
right.
I had to find my own comfort
food. I'm sorry.
That's
can we get a couch in here? We have to stop now, Ivan. All right. And by the way, I do have to bill you now.
It's okay. I'll pay you in dumplings.
So the next one is otaku.
Yeah.
Which in paren you have, guys have geeking out.
Geeking out, yeah.
And again, in a way, like empathy, geeking out is also a universal.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about what you mean or what you meant by geeking out.
Well, in a way, I mean, otaku is probably one of the concepts that most people that have even a passing interest in Japan know about, you know, this whole sort of otaku for anime and for, you know, things like that. And in the cookbook case, you know, we're sort of saying, hey, here's some, we're trying to give you these recipes that are really fun and easy for you, but, you know, we're going to also give you some recipes that take a little more effort, but we wanted to really put it in a separate area so we bombarded people in our first book with this 40-page recipe. And so we really wanted to say, look, most of this book is something you could really do without putting too much energy and be shocked at how delicious food you can make. But we're going to throw you a few crumbs, and we're going to show you a couple of recipes that you could put a little more energy into and feel a little bit more of a sense of accomplishment, and, you know, make your own dumplings, which for Chris and I is actually not that big a deal because we
probably no matter what, even 10, if you're 000. Good at it, you got it takes time.
It still takes time. You still have to make the filling, and you still have to, you know, and you still have to crimp every one of those little things, and
you sort of have to geek out when you're making dumplings, even if you know what you're doing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and then but you know. The fact is that I know that when I cook, I totally geek out, like especially when I'm cooking something new and experimenting, and I'm like just in heaven. I got music going, and I'm moving around the kitchen and dancing, and I'm feeling a really, you know, in a really good headspace. And I think there's a lot of people who cook that feel that way. When they cook, they feel liberated, and they feel joyous. And it's cooking doesn't have to be a drudgery, and I think for many people, it's not. It's something that they do to relax.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I think some people hear geeking out as like, who wants to geek out for 8 hours, you know? And what you're, one of the things that I think you guys are saying in the book is that you can't think of geeking out in terms of time. You know, that geeking out is, if you're in it, you're not even going to be aware of the time that's going by, right?
Yeah. I think that I'm not blowing smoke here. I really point to Serious Eats as inspirational for this book in a couple of ways. One is, you know, I mean, what you and Kenji did with food was to make geeking out this thing that people saw and admired and wanted to also be a part of. It, you know, there are other people who do this, but the deep dive thing.
But also showing them that it doesn't have to be daunting. And that's the one thing, you know, because I'm a professional cook, and so I don't get as overwhelmed because I know all the little tricks and I know about mise en place and I know how to lay stuff out, so I feel more comfortable. And, you know, a lot of people can't, but I think a lot, you know, that's our job. That's what your job at Serious Eats. It's Chris and my job when we write recipes to say, look, just stick with us. Write really great head notes that really assure people of all the little things they can do that'll make, you know, because people get so nervous. It's like, I checked every single item on Amazon, and except for the spicy cod roe eggs, you can get it all on the internet. Let's put it that way.
And then the last two things are good times, and I assume it's not a reference to Jimmy Walker, but maybe it is. I don't know. But what was that all about? It seems like it was a sense that you wanted to share what a good time in Japan was like for you.
Yeah, woohoo.
That was a really muted woo.
There's so many fun, you know, there's so many fun things to cook and have fun with, you know.
Eating in Japan, eating and drinking in Japan is just like completely intertwined, and not only with each other, but with just the notion of having fun. Like every gathering, and this is obvious for a lot of people, but I realize that it's not obvious for everyone that the way we talk about in the book is, here's like a classic conversation that would happen in the States, maybe slightly less so now, would be, oh, we're going to this place tonight. Oh, do they have food? Oh, we should grab a bite beforehand. Or like, and that's sort of the extent of your like, whether or not we're going to go eat. Like, eating and hanging out and drinking are separate things.
Got it.
We're going to go to this club. Oh, we should get a burrito after or whatever. That's just like not how it would happen in Japan. And like, thanks to restaurants and you know, a growing food culture in America, it's becoming more and more like this. But you go, and even if you go to like a karaoke bar or something, you're like, you're snacking the whole time. You're drinking beer and
it's much more of an organic.
Totally. And that's the thing, is just like this whole section is just about trying to recreate this seamless connection when you're entertaining at home between snacking and drinking and maybe a more substantial meal at the end or like a bowl of noodles. And the best thing that we learned when we were most recently in Japan together, Ivan went to a sushi restaurant, and when they were sending them on their way, they gave them like a futomaki, like a giant sushi roll for a take home gift.
And really good.
We've sort of adapted it into, hey, when you have house guests that just won't leave, like, be like, here's your parting futomaki. Like, time to get the hell out of my house. Go eat this at home.
I like this. I might use this. Like, it could work in any culture.
Totally. 100%. Like, everyone's got annoying house guests who just keep on drinking your beer and
I forgot
won't leave.
About that. That was really good, too. That was a super fancy sushi place. I made a friend with this sushi chef dude, and he invited us to go. And this thing, and it was like, I mean, the thing weighed like a pound.
It was so good. It was so delicious.
But it was.
And then the last one is New Year's, which I have never figured out a way to have a good time. And yet you say that when you were in Japan, Ivan, that's where you learned to have a good time.
Well, so my whole life, so my first real memory of New Year's in America was my parents went out of town and I had a party. And I had about 100 people in my house. And don't worry, because I removed every single piece, every piece of furniture,
yeah,
carpet, everything.
Yeah, I'm seeing risky business here.
I put it all in a separate room. The house was empty. And everybody's having a great time. The clock strikes 12. They're popping champagne. It's splaying on the wall. They're kissing me. And I'm like, everybody out. So I was like, you know, I don't understand. Like, I don't understand what is the big deal about New Year's.
Right.
Well, I mean, nobody really, and it's all lip service.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to quit smoking. And then 3 days, I'm like, I thought you quit smoking. Like, yeah, well, you know, whatever. And you're like, oh, okay. But then I moved to Japan. And New Year's, while it's not religious, there's a whole thing. I mean, people start cleaning sometimes even a month before the end of the year. And they start emptying out the closets, getting rid of stuff they don't need. They start dusting and getting everything ready for the end of the year to start fresh on New Year's Day. And, you know, in Japan, like similar to America, people work really, really hard. They don't take a lot of holidays. But New Year's is the one time of the year, around the 27th, 28th, you know, people think business start to shut down.
Really?
And then they all shut down on the 1st, and almost nobody opens until the 4th or the 5th.
Wow.
And it's just the one time of the year in Japan where everything just stops and people relax. And, you know, I really have a lot of respect for my friends and neighbors in Japan, and they work so hard. I just feel like ache for them because they're just exhausted. And I see them around New Year's, and they look so happy and relaxed. And
yeah.
So New Year's food is more. So it's a little like it's a little like Shabbos, you know. You cook all day on Friday, and then you turn off the stove. You got your cholent on this on thing, and you know, and you just eat from that, and you relax. Well, in Japanese New Year's, you know, you cook all these things. A lot of the little treats have different meanings about long life and sweetness and bitterness and whatever, all that stuff. And then you also have opulent fun things. But on New Year's Day, you wake up in the morning and you start drinking and you watch. They have variety shows on TV all day long, and everybody in the country just sits down and watches TV and drinks and eats delicious food.
It sounds so ritualized.
It is, but it's lovely, and it's I'm not a religious person. I'm not particularly spiritual, so I have difficulty with all these different holidays. I love being Jewish, but I don't care about religion necessarily, and this was something that I can really embrace as an outsider, because it's just, I'm just sort of watching it and I'm seeing it and I'm like, can I be a part of this?
Yeah.
And now that I'm the father and I'm the guy in charge,
right.
I run everything. I do all the cooking. I've learned how to make all the little snacks and treats. I do it all.
Really?
I have certain dishes that like I'm known for, not just by my family, but other people. And they're like, could I come on New Year's Day and have that thing you make? And I'm like,
can I come on New Year's Day?
Absolutely. I make some pretty badass.
All right. So. We had Adam Chandler on Special Sauce, who wrote a great book called Drive Through Dreams. I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but it's really good. It's sort of a sociopolitical history of fast food. And he talks about, the KFC Christmas Day thing. Is that real?
In Japan?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, man, and Colonel Sanders is dressed up like in like a Christmas hat. He's got a Santa hat on.
What?
Oh yeah, every year, and it's
you know about this.
And they have never heard about.
And
this.
They have chicken, you know, special boxes of Christmas chicken. Oh, Christmas is huge in Japan, but it's not religious. It's
right.
Just that the Japanese love any reason to celebrate. Any opportunity, they'll have balloons and streamers and sell stuff.
And you have to order your KFC like a month in advance for
now.
Christmas
not me, because I ate
ate
KFC when I was 17. I haven't had it since.
Right, but I mean, a lot of people in Japan,
it's
right?
A big
so
deal.
It's a thing.
It's a thing.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So give me three recipes that you really want people to cook from the cookbook.
Well, I'll steal one from Chris because he's in the same thing. But the tamaki party, I think both of us, it's our favorite.
So explain what a tamaki party is.
Tamaki party is, te is your hand and maki is roll. It's a hand roll, but it's like a fold over, a flip, whatever you want. It's like totally relaxed. It's pieces of nori.
It's a Japanese make your own burrito party.
Yeah, make your own burrito party. And seasoned rice, you can season it or you don't have to if you don't have time.
Okay.
You can, you know, do all kinds of raw fish if you live near a great market and you want to, or you could do only half raw and some cooked stuff.
We might have to have you come do one at Industry City at Sirius Eats World Headquarters.
I think this is like a game changer, honestly. Like, for anybody in the world who has ever tried to have the horrible idea to serve sushi at home to their friends, you understand what a pain it is to like make.
And they're trying to roll in, there's roll rice them, stuck to your
whatever.
Fingers, and it's just like, you know, and you're and everybody's having a great time, and you're sitting back there going, why did I do
but
this?
But everybody wants to do it.
Yeah. Right.
So you just get a pile of, everybody gets their own pile of nori, there's a bowl of rice, and you just make your own rolls. And
right.
Nobody has to slave away in the kitchen. It's my in-laws now who are, you know.
That's how I met when I saw we did the photo shoot at his parents. His in-laws have a beautiful home. They welcomed us to do the photo shoot there. And so Chris said, you know, my mother-in-law, she loves she brought back a bunch of raw fish because they were gonna have it. And I said, well, let's do the tamaki party.
Yeah.
And we just put it all together
Friday now.
And they were all but they used to try to roll it and it was like really stressful, but they loved eating it. And then we showed them, no, you can just make it like this.
So what about you, Chris? What's one that really sticks out?
Well, I'm a relatively new dad, and I do I cook dinner every single night now. And so this is the first book I've ever made that I actually truly cook from. I've always been very self-indulgent with everything I've ever done, and just like made recipes you can't use and had to be cool and difficult and inaccessible. And then Ivan and I started talking about Japanese curry. And we started talking about, and I said, okay, are we going to do a recipe for homemade curry from scratch, none of like the curry blocks? And he said, sure, but the curry blocks are better and they
Oh, yeah, I noticed you said that in the book. It's like, curry blocks, it's hard to improve upon curry blocks.
You just can't.
Because it tastes exactly the way it's supposed to.
We should explain what a curry block is.
So a curry block is basically a roux. I mean, a roux, right, is fat and flour blended together, and in this case, it has an addition of curry powder of some type.
It's you buy it at almost any Asian market. A lot of, like, at least in San Francisco, where I'm from, you can buy it at your local Safeway, whatever. It's pretty ubiquitous now, but it's a packaged thing you throw into broth with meat and vegetables, and it becomes a perfectly rich and thick and glossy curry. The improvement that we've made, the thing that Ivan taught me that has made a tremendous impact in my house is, over the weekend, you braise 5 pounds of pork shoulder in dashi, and you cook it until it's completely tender, and then you split it into 3-quart containers and you put it in the freezer, and then 3 Tuesdays from now you defrost it, you add a little bit more water, add some vegetables, and throw your curry blocks in, and suddenly you have like a perfect braised pork curry. In less than 15 minutes.
And it's homemade, and you can throw your veggies in the microwave and soften them quickly and saute them up a little bit. And you pour the meat and the broth over it, you bring it to a simmer, you drop in the curry box, you mix them around, you make sure they're all melted, otherwise it's not good. And then you have dinner, and it's like the one thing I try to tell people is they always think, well, you're a chef, so, and I'm like, no, I'm just the same as you. I sometimes come home and I got like 20 minutes, and I got boys, and they're like, Dad, now like lately they've just been like, Dad, I'm starving. I'm gonna eat a cookie. I'm like, no cookies. I got this. I promise. 20. Give me 20. And I literally, it's the truth. It's a true story. It's like, and I'm like racing around to get something on the table. And sometimes it's like, and if you say my house, I could serve curry 2 or 3 days a week, and they'll just be like.
But Chris, by the way, because Chris might not know this, Ivan, but he can't serve pork curry on Shabbos.
Yes,
that's why I said you cook it and then you serve it on Tuesday.
Okay,
I will say to wrap up the conversation we were having last time, just about like the shame of that I felt like growing up and having these kind of like intense smells and things to the food I ate. I had this really beautiful moment a couple of weeks ago. I went to like a preschool potluck for my daughter, and I made this whole point of making Japanese curry, the exact curry from the book, and bringing it to this potluck. Thinking like it's really important to me that my kid have that she'd not be ashamed of the food that we eat at home, and so we brought it in there. And the minute I got to this preschool, like all of these like crazy childhood feelings came flooding back, and I was too scared to like put this curry on the table. I actually had my wife do it, who's white and doesn't have these feelings of shame, and like I couldn't. It was horrible. I was like at this crazy low because I thought I had like overcome this,
right.
And it was my daughter now, and I brought this curry to the table, and then you know, on the table it's pizza and pasta and then weird curry on the side, and my little 2.5, almost 3-year-old walks by with her plate and just takes a look at the pizza and just like walks right by and like goes to eat curry. And I was like, it was just like the best moment.
That's a moment.
Had. Yeah, it was pretty incredible. And like, that's why that recipe from the book. And I said this to Ivan in like the acknowledgments, but you know, my kid is growing up eating these recipes really. And it's like, I can't ask for more than that.
And yeah. So even if you can't overcome it.
Hopefully my daughter can.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what we all live for.
The girls are all stronger anyway.
And it was so fun because, you know, Chris would. He would be like, you know, dude, have you been doing any recipes? And I'm like, I'm planning on it. He's like, you can't plan on it, man. You got to do it now. And every once in a while, Chris is like, you got to do it now. And I'm like, oh God, Chris is going to bust my ball. I'm like, okay, I promise I'll do it. And so I would like bang out 10 or 15 recipes and I would send them to him. And then for the next 2 weeks, he would cook all, some of the recipes. And he would call and he'd say, you know, I just made that recipe. It actually came out. And it was also really important to me.
Yeah.
I think Chris is a good cook. So I'm always a little nervous that he'll call and say, dude, what were you thinking? This doesn't work.
Yeah. I called once or twice and said.
Once or twice he did. He said, I think there was a little bit too much meat or there was too much water. So I fixed it. And I'm also, I'm not thin skinned. So he'd say, I fixed the water. And I just assume if you fix the water, I made a mistake and put too much water. So but it was a lot of fun. And I think that way too for Chris, he started working with these recipes in a really natural way because I was just sending him recipes.
Yeah. It's a super personal book for me.
Yeah, it was
really fun. What we eat.
That's a perfect way to end the discussion about the book. As you're both Special Sauce alums, right? So you've done the whole Special Sauce All You Can Eat buffet. So I'm going to only ask you two questions each. So, Chris, who's at your last supper? No family allowed. No, like, people you know, like could be living or dead, can be writers, poets, artists, musicians, athletes, doesn't matter. I just need four people.
Four people? This
four
has gone
people.
Up.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Come on, man. This is Special Sauce,
you know what's insane?
2.0.
You know what's insane is last time I did Special Sauce with you, I hadn't slept for 2 hours and you asked me this question and it's been a huge regret of mine ever since that like I blurted
so
out.
So you got a chance to make it right.
I blurted out Helen of Troy. I had never thought of her since or before then. I am just like completely, completely blanked.
We'll go back to Chris.
You ready?
Yeah.
Jerry Garcia.
Groucho Marx.
Charlie Parker.
This is an awesome party. A little male heavy.
And I was going to say James Cagney.
All right. But so give me a sub for James Cagney.
Well, hopefully she's in a good state of mind, but how about Billie Holiday?
That is one of the most awesome Last Supper tables ever. Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker.
Jerry Garcia.
And Groucho Marx.
Groucho Marx was a pistol.
That's awesome. And what are you eating? What is that august company eating?
Well, you know, I figure, you know, they're sort of mid-century types, so maybe we would eat some kind of really killer roast. You know, maybe we'd have like a 38 Petrus or something, you know, something, right? Something. Maybe that'd be a little too young, you know. I don't know. Right? Depending.
I like that, and of course, Cherry Garcia ice cream.
Cherry Garcia ice cream. Yeah, and then maybe something with mushrooms.
Yeah. All right, Chris, man, you're not getting off the hook.
Oh my God, I had stopped thinking about it because I thought I was off the hook. No, I would have David Foster Wallace.
Okay.
Who was my literary hero?
That's awesome.
Rihanna, because she's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Four people?
Yeah.
Ivan Orkin would be a...
Nah, forget about that. No, Ivan Orkin.
No, I quit. I can't name four.
Okay, that's...
Biggie Smalls.
No, I'm on West Coast, man.
Oh, sorry.
Tupac.
Okay, he was really good.
Tupac. Yeah. All right.
This is a weird table, man.
It is. Tupac, Rihanna. This is awesome.
How about Allen Ginsberg?
Yeah, sure, Ginsburg.
All right.
No, Ruth Bader.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Ooh, oh, she's
now
alive,
that
though.
Is an
she's
awesome
alive,
table.
Yeah. She has to wait.
She
dead.
Could be alive or dead though.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Alive.
Yeah.
Bader, Rihanna.
I like this. This is perfect. This is awesome. All right. This is a question that we didn't even have the last time you guys were both on. So it's just been declared Ivan Orkin Day all over the world.
Well, first of all, I can say that that's a very, very good decision.
what's happening on that day?
What's happening on day? Well, first of all, the Grateful Dead is playing around the world only.
Okay.
Right? We're all eating ice cream sundaes.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, I like this.
And Ice Cream Sundae has followed a meal of everybody's favorite choice, and somehow they're able to have whatever it is that would be their favorite thing to eat.
Ooh, I like this. All right.
So that they're just absolutely in their zone. And then they're like, I don't know why we're all eating ice cream, but they are.
Yeah. And then it's interesting, there's nothing Japanese in there.
Well, it doesn't need to be. You know, it's funny because you know, that's the whole thing about the Japanese thing. It's not, it really isn't who I am. It's just part of who I am.
Yeah, for sure. Which is one of the things the book communicates.
Yeah.
Chris, what's happening on Chris Hing Day?
Most of the day is just taken up by an airing of grievances.
Wait, that's Donald Trump Day.
Well, this is my turn. Donald Trump's first in line, and he takes up 3 hours of the day in which I air my grievances, and they just sit there. It's just it's like the inverse of like a celebrity roast, where I will just roast everybody. And there's got to be a huge audience of people who are just all in agreement with me, and they're all laughing.
There's a huge group of people all over the world agreeing with Chris.
It's Chris Hing Day worldwide. Everybody is in agreement with me. I am airing my grievances about
how different ours is. Mine, I'm offering sustenance and joy.
Well, look, mine's realistic. Unlike my last dinner table, I air my grievances, and after I finish with each person, they all thank me and say one nice thing about me. And then we have dinner somewhere or whatever. Not with those people, but with, Rihanna again.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for sharing your special sauce. This was awesome.
Yes.
Ivan, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Awesome.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
You guys are awesome. And so is the Gaijin Cookbook, Japanese recipes from a chef, father, eater, and lifelong outsider. You can get it wherever books are sold, on or offline. And now, it's time to head over to the Serious Eats Test Kitchen.
Welcome to the world of baking with Stella, and that's like where a rainbow goes.
Details of Stella Park's recipe are at SeriousEats.com.
Today, we're going to be making my favorite pie dough. It involves equal parts flour and butter put into a bowl and smushed together with your hands. That's it. You don't need any fancy ingredients. You don't need a special technique. You cannot make a dough like this in a food processor because the food processor blades are gonna cut up the butter into small, tiny pieces that are gonna be nothing like these big flaky chunks that are gonna make this pie crust so flaky and delicious. So this pie dough is really great for any type of intricate lattice design because we're intentionally cultivating gluten so that the pie is strong and sturdy. You guys, all I'm trying to say is that this pie dough is really good, and you should trust me. I love you. I want you to succeed, but that means that you need to listen to me, okay? Let's do this. So I'll just be like, now we're making pie dough. Flour, salt, sugar. The thing about sugar is that it does not make the pie crust sweet. It just helps with brownings, and then we're gonna whisk them up. This takes longer than you think. For this recipe, I'm gonna use American style butter. This pie dough is nearly 50% butter. We don't need any extra fat. So if you use a European style, it's just adding way too much fat. And also European style butters tend to be a little bit softer, which makes the dough squishy. And this is America. I'm gonna cut it into about 1/2 inch cubes. So I cut them basically into 4 long sticks. Then I come through and just cut them at approximately 1/2 inch intervals. Err on the side of slightly larger pieces rather than extra small pieces because the small pieces will incorporate too much and make the dough a little sticky. Just gonna toss the butter and the flour together, then just break them apart a little bit. We're going to start working the butter into the flour. Find a cube of butter, smash it in your hand, and set it aside. That's all you're gonna do. We want the butter to be cold from the fridge, but not frozen. So if you've seen some kind of like pie dough tip about freezing your butter, don't do that. I didn't tell you to do that. This is so satisfying. This is my personal bubble wrap. Toss it around a little bit and make sure you didn't miss any. Phase 2, adding the water. I'm just gonna add it. This is just cold tap water. We don't need ice water, and we don't ever, under any circumstances, need to add more water or less water. The amount of water is fixed. If the dough seems too dry, it's probably too cold. If the dough seems too sticky or wet, it's probably too warm. I finish kneading it together by hand. When it's mostly together, I turn it out on the counter, and then I'll knead it for another second. And that's all it needs. I'm just gonna roll it into a large rectangle. So don't be afraid to use as much flour as you need to keep it from sticking. All the extra flour can be brushed off in the end. And about, say, halfway through, you can hit it with some more flour and then flip it over. So at this point, I'm gonna do some folding to the dough, and that's gonna create some layers that will help make a super flaky pie crust. And if you see any places that are really rough and uneven, you can kind of like sheet the dough over to even it up a little bit. And from there, you can start rolling for that. It is rectangular and the pie plate is clearly circular. However, it's really hard to preserve a very rectangular shape unless you're working towards it, so it'll all kind of work out in the end. The dough is extremely flexible. It shouldn't crack or tear. And sling it into the pie plate and then just push it down. And that's great. So I'm going to throw it in the refrigerator. It has to be refrigerated for 2 hours in order to firm up the butter that's softened and relax the gluten that we've developed. If you make the dough in advance, pop it in the fridge, and then come to roll it out, you're still gonna have to let it relax for 2 hours. So I like to just shape it right away. It's usually got this like super flaky, buttery crust, like wild blueberries and like lemon, a little hint of coriander or something in there. I like pumpkin pie, what's up with that? Chocolate cream pie, I mean, flaky buttery crust, whatever, chocolate custard inside, toasted meringue on top. Like, who wants that? Do you know what the best way to ensure you get the entire pie? Cough directly over it. No one else will take it from you after that. Pro tip.
Again, details of Stella Park's recipe are at SeriousEats.com. More from our test kitchen next time. That's it for today. Next week on Special Sauce, Kenji will be back to answer with his usual scientific precision your culinary question of the week. Do send in those questions to specialsauce@seriouseats.com. All this and a special guest on next week's Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.